Oregon joined a small club 2 weeks ago when it legalized marijuana for personal recreational use. But Oregon and California have both had medical marijuana for nearly two decades now. More states are embracing pot as medicine, and doctors in those states are considering how they will move on medical pot if and when it arrives. Today's guest is an MD and author. His latest book is Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. David Casseret, MD, is a physician, researcher, and tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. His research focus is on the care of patients approaching the end of life. His last book was Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. David Casseret, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Can we assume from your body of work you are not about sustaining life at any cost?
Well, I'm not about sustaining life at any cost if that's not what patients want. I think there's this myth that palliative care is all about turning off ventilators and bringing people to the end of their life. It's really more about making sure that people have the ability to be comfortable, they get the support that they need, and they make good decisions. So I've certainly helped patients to say to their physicians, look, I really want to live at any cost. But I've also helped patients to think through what that means and to have those discussions with physicians.
Dr. Casseret, give us some sense of the view within the medical establishment of marijuana. I mean, you certainly work in medical school still, so you can probably have a pretty good indication of from one end of the career spectrum to the other what people are saying about marijuana when they carry the title of MD.
I think it's hard to say, and there certainly are some disparate opinions. I would have to say that in general, and it's hard to generalize about an enormous field, but in general, my sense is that many physicians, if not most, right now think of medical marijuana in the way that I did a year ago when I started working on this book as essentially a joke, as a medicine, if you want to call it that, that would always be described inside of sort of ironic quotes, something that people say is a medicine but isn't really. That's not every physician, and that's not all physicians all the time, but in general, if I had to summarize, that's kind of the view that I hear most.
Is it altogether surprising when you think about 70 to 75 years of reefer madness and Cheech and Chong jokes and all the other things that have sort of become the baggage of marijuana?
Oh, it's not surprising at all. It's not surprising that physicians think that way. It's also not surprising that the general public, at least some members of the general public and many legislators think that way. For two reasons. One, you're right, it has a lot of stigma attached, but also because of that stigma and because it's illegal, we really haven't been able to do, meaning researchers haven't been able to do as much research as we could have been doing if it had been legal for the last 50 years. So the combination of stigma and a relative lack of good randomized controlled trials, although there have been some, really puts physicians at a disadvantage, or anybody else, if they want to think critically about whether, when, and how to use medical marijuana.
So was there an event in your own life that, mm-hmm. that turned you to consider marijuana as an alternative treatment, or was it just simply trying to keep up with where some states are going now?
It was trying to keep up with my patients, actually. a retired English professor with advanced cancer came to see me about some of her symptoms, which included pain and nausea, and in the course of that discussion asked me whether I thought marijuana might help her. I live in Pennsylvania where medical marijuana is not legal, and so I gave her the standard party line, what I'd been taught in medical school, which is that marijuana is an illegal drug, there's no evidence to support its use, but she was a professor. She was used to giving students a hard time and was not used to letting students get away with sloppy answers. And so she pushed me, and she said, are you sure there haven't been any randomized control trials? Because I looked online, and I found some. I began to realize that she actually knew more about the evidence base of medical marijuana than I did. And so I promised her I would take a look at the evidence, too, and I would find out, and began looking at the evidence, began talking to researchers, patients, physicians, finally gave her an answer about whether and how I thought it could help her. But also realized that there was a book that could be written, but really needed to be written, because I began to realize as I delved into this that everybody's talking about culture wars or politics or the business of medical marijuana, but nobody was really talking about whether it actually works, how it works, and what the risks were.
I guess you're right. There's so many layers of things that are going on about that, about the fact that people in the medical marijuana business can't use banks because of the federal proscription against it and things like that. I love the fact that this English teacher essentially did to you what two-year-olds do to their parents when they keep asking why. She forced you to drill down to the essence of your answer.
Absolutely. And you're right about the legalities. That's been brought home to me vividly just in the last couple of days. You know, part of writing a book is getting the message out. And so I tried to post an ad on Facebook for a book, which I thought would be fairly straightforward. I've written now a book about the science of medical marijuana, published by Penguin Random House, one of the premier publishing houses in the world, but Facebook disallowed it because of objectionable content. And if you can't even advertise on Facebook for a book about the science of medical marijuana, that tells you something about some of the stigma and some of the challenges that anybody faces, not in advocating for it or against it necessarily, but just trying to open a discussion.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize mm-hmm. Facebook would still have that sort of proscription against that as objectionable content. It's hard. Here again, the perspective is where you're from. I mean, in Oregon, not only is marijuana legal for medical purposes, but also for recreational purposes. I understand in Pennsylvania, medical marijuana is bottled up in the legislature. A couple of key legislators are holding it up there.
Yeah, that's my understanding. It's also the law has gone through several changes. So if it ever emerges, the law will, I think, be very different than what it is in other states, many other states, and certainly different than what it is in Oregon, and will probably be much more restrictive. So no smoked marijuana, for instance, and no vaporized marijuana.
Just oils and essences and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
It sounds like, Dr. Castoret, you encounter lots of patients, not just that English teacher, using marijuana. Does that interfere with the treatments that you're providing for them?
Well, many of the patients I talked to, pretty much all of them actually, who I describe in the book, I met in medical marijuana dispensaries in other states. So they're not my patients. The short answer to that is no. The longer answer is I'm sure that for every patient who asks me about medical marijuana, of my patients, there are many who are using it illegally who don't tell me, who don't ask me. Yes, it can interfere with treatments, but many people want to get off of other medications and use marijuana to get off of other medications that are causing them unpleasant side effects.
All right, much more to talk about the medical marijuana use. David Castoret wrote Stoned, a Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back here in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. David Castoret from the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He has done some analysis of his own on medical marijuana, not the societal ideas and not the financial stuff, but just how does it work as medicine? His book is called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. David, you're right of sharing your own misguided experiences with medical marijuana. What misguided experiences are those?
Really, just one. And I should say for the record that that part of the effects of this experience were due to the fact that I'm not a recreational user. In fact, I can't even remember the last time I used marijuana recreationally. I lead a pretty boring workaholic life. So when I suffered an acute bout of back pain, which many of your listeners approaching middle age will have experienced, or if you haven't, you have something to look forward to.
Yeah, really.
Which can be, right, exactly, it can be awful. The spasms can be, as they were for me, debilitating. And this happened to me at about the midpoint of the book as I was beginning to appreciate that medical marijuana might have some benefits. I wasn't convinced at that point. I'm still not convinced. The evidence isn't perfect, but I was convinced enough to think that this would be an excellent time for some healthy self-experimentation. And so through friends of friends of friends, procured a joint or two, took a day off work, and sat on my back porch and proceeded to try to figure out whether marijuana has any role in the treatment of acute back pain. And I will say that it did make me feel better. So it did seem to relieve some of the muscle spasms that come with an acute back injury. It relieved the pain It also, for me, caused really pretty impressive hallucinations I describe in the book. The odd experience of sitting on my back porch and hearing what sounded like the voices of air traffic controllers coming out my living room window, and I'm pretty sure when I checked later that there were no air traffic controllers. Even odder, actually, was the fact that those voices seemed to come from air traffic controllers who were vectoring aircraft in and out of the Phoenix International Airport, which is odd because I live in Philadelphia.
Right.
And yet I managed to register that was odd. And the take-home for me, although it's an amusing anecdote and it's a nice interlude in the book, that for recreational users, some of that experience is not just okay, but that's kind of the point. And though for many of the people who use marijuana medically, including many of my patients probably, whether they admit it or not, and certainly many of the patients I've talked with, that's actually bad. They don't want to feel high. They don't want to feel stoned. They don't want to feel confused. They certainly don't want hallucinations. They just want relief from their muscle spasms due to multiple sclerosis or nausea due to chemotherapy or pain due to a back injury. That's really what they want. And that made me realize that part of any effort to legalize medical marijuana should really make sure that people using this stuff know exactly what they're getting, know what's in it, so they could begin to predict and potentially avoid those sorts of side effects if, for those people, those effects are side effects rather than the point.
The idea of scouring medical journals to look for information about marijuana, is there much in them about it?
It depends on who you talk to, honestly. I think there was actually a review that came out in a prestigious medical journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association, just a couple of weeks ago, that concluded, and I'm summarizing here a little bit, that concluded that the evidence for medical marijuana overall is not very strong. So that's certainly one take on the literature. That's a pretty high bar, though. I mean, they treated the evidence as less important, less significant, if it included studies that were less than 200 people, for instance, and that's pretty much all medical marijuana studies.
Right.
So if you're a really hardcore scientist, or if you're a bureaucrat at the Food and Drug Administration thinking about legalizing medical marijuana as medicine, there's probably not a lot of evidence. On the other hand, coming from my perspective as somebody who thought initially it was a joke, and also taking the view of many of the patients I had talked to who had tried multiple medications without relief, didn't like the side effects of morphine, really wanted to try something else, then, yeah, there is a surprising amount of evidence to support it, particularly for pain, neuropathic pain, pain that's caused by a nerve injury, for nausea, for loss of appetite that you get with chronic illnesses like HIV or cancer, muscle spasm, and probably for insomnia. Again, not huge amounts of evidence, but enough so that most patients, I think, with those symptoms would look at those studies and say, well, yeah, I know it's not a guaranteed relief, but what is? But for me, at least, yeah, it's worth a try.
It is illegal for research in America. We're talking to David Casaretto out of book Stoned. Do other countries, though, do medical research that was helpful to you at all?
To clarify, it actually is not technically illegal for research in the United States. So there are researchers, some of whom I talked with, who do this kind of work. Barth Wisley is an anesthesiologist in California, for one. Donald Abrams is an oncologist and marijuana researcher, cannabis researcher in San Francisco at UCSF, and many others. So this research can be done. It's very, very difficult, though, to get marijuana. It's even more difficult, according to researchers I've talked with, to get it funded. Drug companies obviously don't want to fund research on marijuana because there's no patent. The government doesn't want to fund it because it's a Schedule I substance. So getting access to marijuana, getting access to funding for research is difficult, but not impossible. So there have been some studies. You're right, though, that I think other countries, particularly Israel, Rafael Meshulam is who I met with in the process of researching this book, is widely regarded as the grandfather of medical marijuana science. And he's a biochemist in Israel, in Jerusalem. And he's done probably most of the research, including a lot of clinical trials, at least in part, not only because he's brilliant, but also because he's not hampered by some of the rules and regulations that researchers in the United States have to deal with.
Let us take a call. We have Ryan and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. David Casserette, the author of Stoned.
Well, thank you. I'm intrigued by this conversation. I think it's important. I just have a comment of, you know, I think we underappreciate the role of helping patients with chronic diseases of a variety of kinds just simply cope, whether it's through the curative process and occupying their minds during that time or just knowing that that chronic pain is there. But my question actually really is that I'm kind of in that evolutionary neuropharmacology and trying to figure out, I don't think we were in, you know, evolved to smoke pot, but there are receptors of all kinds in the body. And can you just sort of give me that sort of pharmacology overview of, you know, how in brain or gut function any of this makes sense? Because I think that that's part of the needed research is just understanding that. And I guess the other problem, which is that, you know, why has there been so few analogous drugs created that has a beneficial, effects in the sort of traditional pharmacopoeia? Anyway, thanks.
All right. Thanks for the question, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Sure. So let me take a swing at that. And that's if I understood the question right, enough to keep us talking for 3 or 4 hours. It's a great question. So I'll try to be brief, but I probably won't do the question justice. So as I heard it, two parts. One, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit, and I apologize to the caller. What do we know about how medical marijuana has the effects that it does? And second of all, why don't we know more about other analogs and other ways of doing the same thing? Again, probably an imperfect rendering of that question, but...
No, that seems fair.
Okay, so I'll do my best. So the quick summary for the first part is there's probably a lot we don't know. Really, really broadly, one thing I discovered in the process of researching Stoned is that the way that medical marijuana works is by hacking into what's called an endocannabinoid system that we all have in our bodies. There were no natural receptors for THC or CBD, tetrahydrocannabinol or cannabidiol, the two main cannabinoids, not the only ones, but the main cannabinoids in marijuana. We're not designed to respond to those, but we are designed to respond to other endocannabinoids that we all have in our bodies, like anandamide. And so when you use marijuana, the cannabinoids in marijuana, THC and CBD, essentially trick the body into thinking that they're part of our natural endocannabinoid system. And it helps to understand that more to answer the second question, because the reason I think we don't know more about how to use what we know about THC and CBD to create new treatments is we're just beginning to understand how THC and CBD interact with all of these receptors that are in our bodies now. One quick summary, again, understanding what THC and CBD do is way more than we could take on now. A couple of quick clarifying points, though. One of those two, again, not the only cannabinoids, but the two most prominent ones and the two ones we have the most evidence about, it's THC THC is the one that makes you feel high or euphoric. It's the one that causes hallucinations in situations where you do get hallucinations. CBD seems to have more of an effect on, if it does, the immune system. So receptors for THC exist in the brain on neurons and in the reproductive system. Receptors for CBD exist on so-called microglial cells, which are the cells that wrap around the neurons in the brain, and on cells in the immune system. So you can kind of think of THC as having brain effects, CBD as having non-brain effects. That actually isn't entirely true. There are some researchers who are thinking that CBD actually might have profound effects on pain in ways we don't really understand. But that's kind of a quick summary.
So in rough approximation, THC is on the brain and CBD is on the body?
Right, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. Very rough, I understand. Go ahead.
It is fair to say that it's THC that causes that feeling of euphoria.
David Casserette, MD, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book of research on medical marijuana is called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Comments and questions are welcome at 800-838-3760 around the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. To reframe, at the start, were you leaning either pro or con on medical marijuana?
I would have to say that I was definitely leaning con, although I think that would honestly give me too much credit. I was leaning against only because I never really thought of it. It was an opinion that I had without really examining it. It's not like I looked at the evidence before I started working on this book and decided that it didn't work. I just, frankly, hadn't looked at the evidence, hadn't thought about it at all.
If a self-described workaholic MD who works in a medical school doesn't think much about marijuana, I have to assume that everybody else around you is also not really thinking in those terms. It sounds like it really hasn't entered the academy in medicine yet.
I think that's fair to say, although there are obviously a lot of exceptions. Many of the researchers I spoke with, Barth Bilsey, Christine Rabinac, Raphael Mishulam, Donald Abrams, I mean, these are all people in the academic establishment who not only have much different views about potential benefits of medical marijuana, but they're also doing rigorous research and advancing the science. In fact, you know, if there's any hero to this story, it's really researchers like them, because they're taking some flack from the establishment because they're doing research on medical marijuana, which puts them outside the norm. But they also get flack, I think many of them, from many people in the medical marijuana community, advocates, because they're trying to both point out risks and potential benefits. So many researchers in this field, there aren't that many, but there are some, really are trying to walk a very careful line between being accepted by the establishment and then also being accepted by medical marijuana advocates who are pushing for legalization.
Interesting, because in some cases legalization might not be as fast if we understood things a little better.
Or it could be faster.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true. All right, among the names you've mentioned, you didn't mention Zach Klein in Israel yet. There's an interesting story here about how he administered marijuana and how well it worked.
Yeah, Zach Klein is an amazing guy who I met through Raphael Mishulam, the grandfather of medical marijuana. Dr. Mishulam put me in touch with Zach. Zach is not a researcher or a physician. He's actually a filmmaker. And he became interested in the potential benefits of medical marijuana when he got some for his mother when she was suffering from advanced cancer. And he became impressed by the effects and that he observed and also what he learned. And he became took on a role that they have in Israel that I've never heard about anywhere else. He became an educator. So for people who are trying medical marijuana for medical purposes but have not used it for recreational purposes, don't know how to use it, he would go in and he would help to teach them how to use it. And he describes to me, as when I met him in Tel Aviv, he describes getting a call from a nursing home for a patient, a nursing home resident, who had gotten permission to use medical marijuana. Her family had gotten permission on her behalf, but the nursing staff didn't know how to get her to use it because she was very, very seriously demented. But she was having a lot of behavioral disturbances that they weren't able to treat with other drugs. The other drugs were causing side effects that were really quite dangerous. And so they looked to him for help. And so he began to work with this particular nursing home and patients and families to try to understand whether maybe medical marijuana might be useful in treatment of advanced dementia with the sort of agitation and confusion that many people experience. And I should say this is just his experience.
Mm-hmm,
to my knowledge, there haven't been randomized controlled trials.
Fair enough, because it would not make them, yeah, it doesn't necessarily transfer to something bigger about what happened here. Could, for example, I mean, since we know about THC and CBD and have at least the beginnings of ideas about how they work on the body, I mean, could they be distilled to pill form like tomorrow?
They certainly could, and to some degree they have. So there's a drug on the market now called dronabinol. One trade name is Marinol, and it's THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, in pill form. It comes in a variety of doses. It's legal. It's approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treatment of loss of appetite. So it's there. It hasn't really gained traction because, at least when I've prescribed it to my patients, they don't like it. They say it doesn't do much useful for them, and its effects are hard to predict. One patient told me, you know, this doesn't make me feel good. It doesn't make me feel high. It doesn't really do much of anything. But it's out there, and it's a model of what the science of medical marijuana might be. Something else that maybe has more credibility and more potential is a drug called Sativex, which was developed by a company called GW Pharmaceuticals, which is based in Toronto. And I should clarify for listeners that I don't have any affiliation with any of these companies. I don't take money from the pharmaceutical industry. I don't do consulting. I don't sit on any boards.
Good to know.
And they've developed a drug called Sativex, which is very small amounts of THC and CBD dissolved in alcohol. So you could administer both THC and CBD in very concentrated forms in drops under the tongue. And that's approved for use in Canada, in the UK, and it's in clinical trials for cancer pain now in the United States. And that's neat to me because there's a lot of interest in figuring out what CBD might do, a lot of interest in THC, but what effect does CBD have? And might CBD be effective either in conjunction with THC or on its own? And this is a great way for patients to get access to both and to get access to both in a controlled way as opposed to puffing on a joint. You'd be able to titrate the doses very, very carefully. So that's kind of where the field is moving.
Is there even a good matrix at this point to indicate, you know, this THC plus this much CBD equals this effect, or are we still a while away from that?
I think we're still a while away from that, although one of the researchers I mentioned earlier, Barth Wilsey, an anesthesiologist at UC Davis, has been doing trials that use lower and lower concentrations of THC, higher concentrations of CBD, to try to figure out where that sweet point might be that you'd get pain relief without some of the confusion and mind effects that some people don't like.
David Cassaret wrote Stoned. We'll come back and talk with the doctor and you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about medical marijuana, but in a very clinical sense, in a very research-oriented sense, with Dr. David Cassaret from the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He decided he really wanted to know what we do know about marijuana as medicine, and he went in search of answers and produced the book Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the region, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to this discussion earlier when Ryan called in to ask about THC and CBD and how they work in the body. And you mentioned endocannabinoids. Does that mean that there are substances in the body that are similar to THC and CBD already?
Yeah, so one of the best known is a substance called anandamide that was discovered by Raphael Mechoulam, who I mentioned several times, and somebody working in his lab, Bill Devane. And it comes from the Sanskrit for ananda.
Oh, there is ananda in there. Okay, I thought I recognized that.
Yep, so the bliss molecule. Apparently Bill Devane was studying Sanskrit because that's what biochemists do in their spare time, and decided to name it the bliss molecule. There are others, but that's probably the best known. It also has, obviously, the best name. But THC and CBD and other cannabinoids outside in the world seem to act by fooling the body into thinking that they're either anandamide or 2-AG or any of the other endocannabinoids that we all have in us.
Interesting. So it's just in the same way that you can cut coffee out of your life and your body will produce something similar to caffeine to keep you alert and awake. I mean, the body can produce essentially the same sorts of things that are delivered by THC and CBD, or those cause the body to produce those more?
They actually substitute for, although mm-hmm. it's obviously not that simple. One example is morphine, for instance. The body doesn't come naturally equipped with morphine receptors. We didn't evolve to be able to use morphine derived from poppies, but we do have what are called enkephalin receptors. And morphine and other opioids essentially act on those receptors and fool the body into thinking, or at least partially thinking, that what they're being given is those enkephalin. So and many drugs work in that way. They substitute for other neurotransmitters or hormones and trick the body into thinking that they're native hormones.
We'll be talking about OxyContin and heroin tomorrow on the Exchange, and I wonder if, from what you've learned, if you think at this point that properly administered marijuana might decrease the demand for these and the addictions that come with them.
I think it's too soon to tell, but it's certainly, there's enough data out there to make me optimistic. And those data come from two sources. One, in terms of evidence, there was a study that was published probably about a year ago in one of the American Medical Association journals that found that in states that had legalized medical marijuana, or recreational marijuana, I believe, pre-post changes over time, there were fewer opioid-related deaths in those states after legalization, which the authors took to be at least consistent with a hypothesis that some people who normally would be using either OxyContin illegally, potentially legally, heroin, other opioids that can cause death, they're switching to marijuana or using less of and using more marijuana, which, although it does have risks, fatal overdose is not one of them. You can't fatally overdose on marijuana. The other evidence I have that might be true is I talk with a lot of patients who were prescribed opioids legally by their physicians but didn't want to take them. They said the opioids made them feel goofy, gave them side effects like dizziness, confusion, nausea, constipation, and so stopped using opioids or backed off on the dose to use marijuana instead. So it's too soon to make the call and say that marijuana is either preventing deaths or preventing the potential for abuse, but it's an enticing possibility, I think, to many of us.
I'm struck at this moment by the possibility that the old belief might be reversed, that instead of marijuana being a gateway drug to harder drugs, it might be the other way around, that people would dispense with heroin and OxyContin if they could get a hold of marijuana more easily.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility that's making many people interested. It's also worth noting that pretty much all of the data that I've seen suggesting that marijuana might be a gateway drug comes from recreational use. So we really don't know whether people using medical marijuana medically, whether for them marijuana is a gateway drug. You know, it's one thing to imagine that it might be a gateway drug for a 22-year-old kid who's using marijuana recreationally along with drugs, other drugs and alcohol, but to say that a 55-year-old administrative assistant from Medford, Oregon, who uses it 3 times a week to help her get to sleep, is she really going to be hooked on cocaine or crystal meth in a year? Maybe, but so much of the data come from recreational use that it's kind of hard to tell whether there really is a gateway effect for medical use.
Let me take a phone call here, and let's see, we got line 4 going on, and this is Rick in Florence. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. David Cassaret. Rick, you there? Rick in Florence. All right. Not there. We were talking about the things that people use this for, and you ask a great question yourself in the book, which is this a Band-Aid? And given that you work in palliative care most of the time anyway, is it okay if it is a Band-Aid?
It certainly is for a lot of symptoms, and maybe for most. I asked that question about its use in treatment for PTSD. And I talked with a researcher named Christine Rabinac, who is not dismissive, to be clear, of the Band-Aid hypothesis, if you want to call it that. Her research focuses on people with PTSD and the biological basis of PTSD, so she knows better than anybody how debilitating it is. And I think she was the one who used that phrase in talking with me, and I think she's all in favor of Band-Aids, things that make people feel better. I think her point, and mine too, was not that Band-Aids are bad necessarily, but her research was fascinating to me because it doesn't just examine whether marijuana or its constituent cannabinoids might relieve symptoms, but she's really interested in the possibility that cannabinoids, THC in particular, because of the way that it affects how we process memories, and particularly emotional memories, she's wondering whether THC might help to essentially break the links between emotions and memories that cause PTSD. So she's not dismissing the possibility of PTSD, that marijuana might be a Band-Aid for PTSD, but she's thinking it might, down the road in the right way, might actually either be a treatment or be an effective adjuvant to treatment, so combined with desensitization therapy or other forms of psychotherapy, could actually cure people.
Our caller came back, and I think he's got a question in this general vein anyway. Rick and Florence, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. David Cassaret, the author of Stoned.
Okay, do you have me this time?
We do.
Okay, good. Actually, it's an observation and a question in a sense, but I'm somebody who started smoking marijuana, I guess, mid-70s, was never a heavy user, but something I noticed about 10 years ago and pretty much quit smoking it over it was I started to get anxiety attacks, which isn't that uncommon, I guess. But what I found interesting about it was that if I had drink, say, three or four just regular cheapy beers, the anxiety attacks would just totally disappear. And I've never had any explanation of, well, why the anxiety attacks, but particularly why it is that if you drink a little bit of alcohol, and we're not talking about quantity of alcohol, it just disappears completely. The anxiety just goes away completely.
All right. Interesting points to bring up. Thanks for that, Rick. Appreciate it. And in fact, in the PTSD trials, there was concern about anxiety with marijuana, wasn't there, David?
There's a general concern about anxiety associated with marijuana use for two reasons. I think, as many of us know, although the ingredients of marijuana, THC and CBD, THC in particular, can be calming, taken in the wrong way for somebody who's unsuspecting in a particularly large dose, actually the result can be increased anxiety. The other reason to think about that link between marijuana and anxiety is one that I didn't really think about in advance, but was brought home to me when I started looking at dependence and addiction. And there is actually, I had no idea this is true, but apparently there is a withdrawal syndrome. So several patients I talked to describe using marijuana regularly for treatment of pain, and they said that if they stopped using, they began to feel agitated, had trouble sleeping, and felt anxious. So I can't say that either one of those was going on in the case that the caller described. I have no idea. But those are two ways in which anxiety appears in medical marijuana users or recreational users.
What about the part of his discussion where he was referring to alcohol seeming to dull that anxiety effect?
Yeah, I don't know, but we know that alcohol acts on GABA receptors in the brain as well as others. It's pretty effective at relieving anxiety. I mean, how many times have you been at a party with people you don't know and grabbed a drink and felt better? It doesn't take a whole lot of research to know that alcohol can be effective in anxiety relief. So again, I'm not sure that's what was happening. That's certainly one hypothesis, though.
You did consume marijuana in a couple of different forms, evidently, as part of the research for Stone. And in one of the cases in particular, speaking of alcohol, it was consumed as part of a beer. Is that right?
It was. I tried both beer and wine with really pretty unimpressive effects.
The beer in particular, there were some issues with taste and texture, I understand.
Yeah, I never really thought through this. I used to dabble in home brewing. The results are usually spectacularly awful, so I fortunately gave that up. But the way it was explained to me by people who actually do this and do it much better than I ever managed to is that if you put the marijuana buds into the beer before the boiling stage, that's good because you wind up boiling everything, killing off any bacteria that you don't want to drink. The problem, and that was the case in the beer that I tried, the problem is it tastes like mown grass and manure drunk out of an old boot. It was really pretty disgusting. Other people put the marijuana in later after the boiling stage, but then there's the risk that you'd wind up with contaminants that, if they don't make you sick, would at least also make it taste pretty bad.
Doesn't sound very good all around. Let's go to take a call from Richard in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. David Cassaret.
Hi. I was wondering if there's any research on essential tremor and the effects of the cannabinoids on, reducing essential tremor.
As related to Parkinson's disease?
I have a mild or a moderate case of essential tremor, but as a musician, it's quite problematic.
Oh, I can see that. Okay, thanks for that, Richard. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a great question, just for the other listeners. So essential tremor is something that looks like Parkinson's disease but isn't. It's what's often called a benign tremor, that is not associated with any of the other problems that Parkinson's disease causes, but it's the same looks the same to the untrained eye. Used to be called benign tremor. It's not, because it's anything but benign. It can be very, very disruptive, as the caller's story indicates. It's really a great question. We talked earlier about Zach Klein, and there's one moment in the film that he produced about medical marijuana called Prescribed Grass that was aired in Israel. There's a moment in which a man with Parkinson's disease, so different, but a man with Parkinson's disease who was never able to write his name since he had the diagnosis, tries medical marijuana and is able to write again. And that instance was fascinating to me, and I talk about it a bit in the book, because several researchers saw that film, heard about that example, and did a randomized controlled trial. I mean, they were basically inspired by that form of crowdsourcing research, heard the story and decided to do a trial. That trial didn't show any benefit for the tremor in Parkinson's disease. So at least for Parkinson's disease, there doesn't seem to be an effect. For essential tremor, though, the mechanisms are different. And as far as I know, we don't know. I have not, doesn't mean they don't exist, but I have not seen any clinical trials. The hidden message here, putting both of those stories together, though, is that because it's so, so hard to do research in the United States on medical marijuana in terms of funding and legalities, one of the best opportunities to figure out, at least in a preliminary way, what works and whether marijuana might work for essential tremor is to begin to crowdsource research. And so actually I worked with a group of students at the University of Pennsylvania to create a website, marijuanaresults.org. We actually just started a Kickstarter campaign to try to build that site up and make it functional, in hopes of letting people share their stories so people like the caller could go online and find other people who have used marijuana for essential tremors, figured out what their experience was, whether it was positive or negative, and make better decisions about whether and when and how to use it, at least until we have good randomized controlled trial evidence.
All right, a lot of work went into the book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. David Casaret at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School wrote it and joined us today. David, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, take care.